9 minutes past midnight. Welcome to November 28th, 2020 in the world's greatest city. Phil Medikian for Dave Plyer on 720 WGN. He is a founding member of one of the biggest and baddest bands of the 70s with over 30 million records sold. We're talking 16 gold and platinum albums. He's written songs like I'm Your Captain, Closer to Home, Bad Time, Foot Stomping Music. That just scratches the surface. It's Mark Farner of Grand Funk Railroad. Mark, welcome to WGN.
Hey, it's my pleasure to be here with you, Brother Phil.
It is my pleasure to talk to you. I got to start out with one of the quotes that I love about you. David Fricke, I believe is how you pronounce his name, of Rolling Stone. The quote is, "You cannot talk about rock in the 70s without talking about Grand Funk Railroad." That's an awesome quote.
That is an awesome quote. I love it.
And it's true.
Hey, I appreciate it. Thank you, Phil. I appreciate that so much.
Some things I don't think people may know about you, about your family, first of all. Your father was in World War II, and he received 4 Bronze Stars.
Yeah, tank driver in the 7th Armored Division. He was in 4 major battles in... And he was a blessed man because a lot of tank drivers didn't get to see a second battle. And the Sherman tanks were inferior to the German panzers.
Right, right. And speaking of tanks, your mother was the first woman in the U.S. to weld Sherman tanks at Fisher Body in Flint, Michigan. How's that?
That's remember her picture being on the newspaper, the Flint Journal, standing on top of a Sherman tank with her Striker in her right hand and her helmet tipped back and a beautiful smile on her face. And it's like, you know, back in the Second World War, we can do this, you know. It's like the women got their group, their poop in a group, and went forward with this. So that my mom was, I'm proud of her for her heritage and for her courage to be who she was.
Absolutely.
God rest her soul.
You come from good stock. There's no question about that, my friend.
Thank you.
Influences. Let's talk about that. What made you pick up a guitar and be in front of people and be the huge rock star you were? How did that come about?
Well, I was playing football in school, and we scrimmaged a varsity team. I was playing JV football. We scrimmaged at varsity, and I ended up with water on a knee and fractured fingers. And the doctor told my mother that I would not be playing any more football, and I would not be running track in the fall because of my injuries. And she felt sorry for me, so sorry that she got me 6 lessons and rented acoustic guitar, a K. It would have been better used as a bow and arrow. The strings were so far away from that neck. But 6 lessons and a rented flat top, and I got started. My first lesson, he taught me that I have to keep my fingernails on my left hand trimmed down there so they don't get in the way on the fretboard, and he taught me how to tune the guitar that first go round. Then the second one, we started playing a little bit and did that ditty, da 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 da, you know, this simple stuff. But after the third lesson, he called my mother and he had a shotgun accident. It was bird season in Michigan, and he was out hunting with his 12 gauge, and his foot got in the way. So he called my mother, said he couldn't do any more lessons because he's, you know, recovering and what have you. So told her to just have me go and watch the band of these guys that I knew in high school that had a band and learn from them because I was picking up quick just by ear and just by him, you know, teaching me without being able to read music. So that's what I did. I went and hung with the guys, and I learned how to play. My mother bought me my first electric guitar. Came out of Finger Hut catalog. You remember Finger Hut?
Wow, yeah.
I had a Harmony electric guitar and matching amplifier.
There you go.
So, yeah, man, I was just strutting around with that, and that got me started. And you know, I started playing when I was 15 years old, and Grand Funk, we had our first million selling album when I was 20.
Oh my goodness.
It went fast, brother.
How did you guys get together? How did that work out?
Well, Don and I were in a band that had overstayed our welcome out in the Boston area, but we were trapped because of a snowstorm there in 1969, and we were 2 weeks late getting out of there. And by the time we got back, two of the guys in the band, the keyboard player and one of the guitar players, were married, and they told us they had to quit because their wives forbid them to go anymore after being stranded like that. And this is long before cell phones, Phil, so there was no communication. They were just, where the hell are these guys?
Sure,
so
sure.
Anyway, we said, you know something? Our next band, we're not going to have any married guys or any guys where the women are going to get in there and break up the band. And then I told Brewer, I said, listen, we ought to make a three-piece band. I said, Cream does it. Hendrix does it. We could do some rock, funk, three-piece music. And so we went up, and we were at a place in Bay City, Michigan, and we were going to go into Delta Promotions, where the guys that sent us to Boston were out of there. We were going to give them a piece of our mind and find out what happened to the cash. But while we were in the waiting room, there was a band rehearsing in their facility, and I didn't know who it was. You can't see through walls, but man, I'm telling you, you could hear the bass through that wall. And I told Brewer, I said, dude, whoever this bass player is on it. We ought to see who this is. Well, when they took a break, out walked Mel Shocker, who was playing bass at the time with Question Mark and the Mysterians.
Right, right.
And I asked Mel, I said, hey, we are going to start a three-piece band, and I'm not to tear you away from anything here, but I would like to offer you the job of bass player. He says, dude, I have been looking to get out of this band. Some things went down, and I just got to, he said, this makes me happy. So anyway, we started the following week at the Flint Federation of Musicians Hall on Averill in Flint, Michigan, and that's where a lot of the first songs from On Time, the first album of Grand Funk, were written, right there at that rehearsal hall.
Right. How did the name come about?
Terry Knight, our first manager, was also a songwriter, and he wrote a song titled Grand Funk Railroad, and he said, you guys ought to take the name of my song and call your band that, because that's a cool name. We said, okay. And that was it.
Very cool. Easy.
Yeah, man.
Easy.
Yeah.
So I'm going to bring up another quote of Howard Stern. I saw you do I'm Your Captain on his show, and that was just a phenomenal version of that, by the way. He called you the brains of the outfit.
Thank you, brother.
Is that true?
Well, as far as songwriting, I wrote 92% of the songs.
Right.
So if they did come through my brains, I cannot deny that.
There you go. After a while, you parted ways with Terry Knight.
Oh, yeah. It was Terry Knight and the Pack is where I first got, you know, introduced to Terry Knight, and I was playing bass in Terry Knight and the Pack.
Oh, okay.
And I switched from bass to guitar after we got rid of Terry. We just said, look, Brewer and I were talking. We said, we can sing better than this guy, and he's taking a lion's share of the money, and we're splitting this much. Like, this isn't really cool. So we started the Pack, just the Pack, and I was, at that time, I was just stand-up lead singer, and then we had a guitar player and a bass player behind us and a keyboard player with Brewer on the drums. And then when that fiasco happened out in Boston, it all changed. But Terry Knight was our manager after, of course, we had left them and did the Pack thing. When we got rolling and he knew we were writing original songs, he contacted Don Brewer and told him that he had a lot of connections in New York City. He was living in New York City, and he would like to manage the band because he thinks he could do some good for us. Mm. And that's how Terry Knight came on board as manager. And when we left him, it was 3 years after we had signed our initial contract with him, but we had discovered that the money that we made on our European tour in 1970, he says, "Boys, you guys can't take this, it was like $1.5 million. You can't take this money back and take the tax hit on it." He says, "Let's leave it in the most stable world currency," which at the time was Deutschmarks, I believe, "and let's start a Swiss bank account." And we went, "All right." So he went and did whatever he did with the money, and we never saw a penny of it.
Oh, man.
And there was some other shenanigans that went on. And like the first year that we were together as Grand Funk Railroad with Terry managing, he put us on a $350 a week salary. So it was more money than we'd been making, and he knew that, obviously.
Sure.
But it sure wasn't it wasn't fair.
Right.
Because there was a lot of other money going someplace.
Right.
And when we finally determined and made our determination that we were going to drop him, and you know, we went and we got a hold of Eastman. You know, it's a McCartney's wife's brother, the Eastman in New York City attorney, and the lawsuit went on. We settled out of court, and the one thing we did walk away from it with, Phil, is the name. We had incorporated that name, and there was nothing he could do about it, although he tried to stop us at the gig we did at Madison Square Garden in New York City for Phoenix House. And this is a charity gig. We weren't making anything. We're giving all the money to Phoenix House, and he came in with the sheriff and the attorneys and stuff, and they tried to stop our show, and they were going to confiscate the equipment, and some of our roadies heard about what was going on, and they came up on stage. There was a good six or eight guys, and all of our roadies looked like Vikings. They looked like trees standing there, and they surrounded these guys, and they said, "We don't know what you thought you was going to do, but this show is going on, and you all are going to get off this stage right now."
Wow.
And they left.
Good to have good friends, right?
Oh, buddy.
We're going to talk about more fun things next.
Yeah.
More with Mark Farner, 720 WGN. 1225, Phil Mannicki for Dave Plyer, 720 WGN. Talking with Mark Farner of Grand Funk Railroad. So you dropped the railroad for a while. How did that come about?
Well, actually, Phil, it was kind of like, you know, Chicago Transit Authority. The fans shortened it for them to Chicago.
Okay.
So the fans shortened Grand Funk Railroad to Grand Funk, and that's just how it occurred.
Got it. Let's go back to the very beginning, before you guys were big and whatever. I'm going to take you back to the 4th of July weekend in 1969, the Atlanta Pop Festival.
Oh, yeah.
My information is you guys played that for free, right? You just wanted a gig.
Yes. And the attorneys that were doing the legal work for that Pop Festival were none other than Terry Knight's attorneys in New York City.
Okay.
And they made a deal with the promoters of the festival on the fee that they would charge them, adjusted fee, if they would let Grand Funk Railroad open the festival for free, go on for free. And so they agreed, and through a long story short, our friend who loaned us his van, and we rented a U-Haul trailer to get our equipment and our asses down there. The trailer flipped over on the way. It was a fiasco. When we got to Atlanta, the roadies were soldering wires together. The chassis had ripped off. The big transformers came off the chassis, and the wires and everything were just shorting out. So they had to solder it back together, lay the transformers next to the amplifier on top of the speaker cabinet. But we went on, and everything worked. And we'd not seen the audience. We'd heard the audience, you know, through and could peek out and see the first couple of, you know, few rows there. But when I got up on stage and I actually saw the size of this audience, I looked at my guitar tech. I said, dude, I have to pee so bad. But he says, nah, dude, get your ass out there. So I went out. We went out, and we really, we were so geeked to play that gig. And it came off. They didn't want us to leave the stage. They kept calling us back for encore and encore. And the promoters moved us up to a 7 o'clock the following night, and then up to 11 o'clock on the third night at night with all the lights. And, man, the word went out from that pop festival, because, I mean, it wasn't just people from Atlanta, Georgia there. It was people from all over the country that were there. And the word went out about Grand Funk Railroad and the energy that came off that stage. And that was like our introduction to the real deal.
Well, you mentioned Chicago. They were there. Chicago Transit Authority was there.
Yeah.
Blood, Sweat, and Tears were there. Creedence was there. Joe Cocker, Janis Joplin, Led Zeppelin, Spirit. That's a lineup.
Yeah, dude.
Whoa.
Some biggies.
That's incredible. And that kind of worked out for you guys, because isn't that where you got your deal with Capitol Records? Because of
yes.
that gig, right?
Yes, it is.
So it all worked out.
Yeah, it sure did, brother. It was kind of like we were supposed to go down that road.
Right, right. Now, Woodstock happened later. This was 4th of July weekend. This was August. And it would have been cool for you guys to be there, but that didn't work out, right?
Right. I think we were at Strawberry Fields up there, Montreal, Canada, doing a festival up there, and we couldn't get back in time to do the Woodstock thing, but such is life.
Yeah, it's time to make an album. That story after this update from the Northwestern Medicine Newsroom on 720 WGN. Filming it for Dave Plyer on 720 WGN. Talking to Mark Farner of Grand Funk Railroad. It's time to make your first album, On Time. Tell us about that.
The album was, it was pretty much done as far as the songwriting. And we went to Cleveland Recording, and they recorded it on 8-track Scully tape.
Right.
It was like, man, that's big time. I had never seen anything over a quarter inch.
Sure.
Reel to reel. So, yeah, we went in, and within 3 days, I think it was pretty quick. And I thought, wow, are we done already? Because we just go in and we knocked out the tracks because we had already, you know, been rehearsing them and knew the songs.
Sure.
Knocked them out, and then we did the overdubs the next day, and Terry mixed on the third day. We were gone. We were out of there.
Wow.
Yeah.
That's nuts. All right, we're going to take you to Shea Stadium, 1971. You sold out Shea Stadium in 72 freaking hours. Are you kidding me?
Yeah, dude.
Faster than the Beatles did.
Faster than the Beatles, and I can tell you that I was strutting around on that stage that night, because all the songs that we were playing were penned by me, and I thought, these people like my music.
That's got to be an incredible feeling, man.
Oh, my God, dude. Yeah, you just saying it gives me goosebumps, because I had goosebumps on top of my goosebumps when I was on that stage. And that's the audience when they sang, because that the stadium, the audience was in like a semicircle, and we were set up at second base.
Okay.
And when that's like the focal point of that audience. And when they would holler and when they would sing closer to home, they overcame the volume of the PA.
Wow.
Wow. Pinch me.
Goosebumps indeed, my friend. It was around this time that you guys were considered like the loudest band, right?
Yes. we had West amplifiers, and the guy was Dave West out of Flint, Michigan. And before Grand Funk started, I was working for Dave West, making speaker cabinets and doing circuit boards, soldering circuit boards, doing you know, all the different steps, because anybody that worked for Dave, you never knew what you were going to do that day. He'd just put you on something. But myself and Dennis Bellinger, who ended up playing bass for Grand Funk in the early 80s, we both worked for Dave West prior to having a career in music.
Got it. Got it.
Yeah.
How do you write a song? Is there a set process to do that, or does it just evolve organically?
Yeah, it is kind of a, it is an organic evolution, but a lot of my songs came from driving a tractor, you know, cultivating. I've been, you know, farming all of our life, and so I'm very familiar with the operation of tractors and combines and hay binds and, you know, the farm machinery.
Sure.
And while I go around in circles in the field, I'm hearing, like, music, you know.
Mm-hmm.
The drone of the engine put a key in my ear, and I would just start singing, and I'm going along. And, man, I'd come around, and I'd get close to the barn. I'd park that tractor, jump off, and go down and write what was in my head, and go back, take another couple laps in the field, jump off the tractor, write the second verse, go back to the track. You know, this is actually how it happened and occurred this way. And then when I got lyrics first and melody like that, then I could put the guitar around it, you know, come up with a line that would support the lyric and the melody. But a lot of my songs came just from jamming on the guitar. You know, they just gave me a certain feel. I went, wow, man, that sounds really cool. I bet if I sung like, hey, baby, you know, I mean, you start thinking in your mind, and the song evolves, and out it comes. I think, too, because when I'm writing, I'm in a place of consciousness somewhere not in present moment, you know, to the physical surroundings, but somewhere between subconscious state and conscious, there is this little avenue you get on where it's like a creative vein. I tell people, they go in there, and there's this trough, big trough, and these songs are bobbing by in the trough, and so you bob for songs out of the trough.
Wow. More about the songs of Mark Farner. He's with Grand Funk Railroad, and we're going to talk to him more about that next here at 720 WGN. Me 1243, Phil Manickian for Dave Plyer on 720 WGN. We're talking to Mark Farner of Grand Funk Railroad. That song, I'm Your Captain, Closer to Home, that I'm telling you right now, man, that is just 10 minutes of cool.
You know, that song, I prayed for that song, Phil. I went to bed, I always say my prayers, and the night I in particular that I prayed for that song, I just, after I, you know, I didn't. Now I lay me down to sleep. I pray the Lord my soul to keep. If I should die before I wake, I pray the Lord my soul to take. Then you go into blessing all of your aunts and uncles and the whole family. And then at the end of that, I put a little P.S. on there, and I said, God, would you give me a song that would reach and touch the hearts of those you want to get to? And so I fell asleep. I got up in the middle of the night, like 3 in the morning or something like that, and I have a legal pad next to my bed so that when I'm inspired, I don't forget it. I make myself set up and write down what the inspiration is. So I grabbed that pad, and I started writing. You know, everybody listened to me, and, you know, I'm like, wow, this is kind of crazy stuff, but I let it keep going. And I just put it down. I fell back to sleep and went out in the morning, and I got a cup of coffee going. I got my flat top in my hand. I'm looking at my horses out in the pasture, and I start playing. You know, it was like, whoa, wait a minute here. That's pretty cool. And then I grabbed an inversion of a C chord that I'd never played prior to that moment, and it just, it spoke to me. I looked at my hand. I said, what the heck? And I just started playing the lick. And then I thought, wow, maybe those lyrics, that is really lyrics to a song in the other room. So I went and got them, sat them down in front of me, and I started playing that lick over and over again. Da, 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 da. Everybody, you know, it just like came. It just started. The melody came. The changes came. And then when it you know, goes into that minor, when I'm in my cabin dreaming, you know, it all came to me right then. And I took the song to rehearsal that day. And those guys sat there and looked at me and shook their head. They said, Farner, this song's a hit, dude. I said, it's long. It's a real long song. But they were right. It was a bona fide hit. And it reached the hearts of those people that the creator wanted to get to. And just so happens, a lot of them were Vietnam veterans, and they were thousands of miles from their home, and they wanted to be in their home. So
perfect.
Really struck a note with them.
Love the wah-wah on there, too, by the way. Nice job.
Thank you.
All right, questions. You worked with some different producers. Todd Rundgren on We're an American Band in 73. How did that come about? How did you work with Todd?
Hey, dude, we put names in a hat. And Drew Todd.
Stop it. Stop
I'm not
it.
Kidding you. We just had, I don't know, maybe there was 15 producers in there that our manager, and then Lynn Goldsmith, our publicist, she came up with the Todd Rundgren name and wrote it down. And there was some other people, you know, and they shook that hat up, and I reached in and pulled out Todd Rundgren there. That's how he got picked. And I'm so glad that we got to work with him, because I love him. He's a musical genius in my estimation, and an easy guy to work with. We are in there playing our hearts out, doing this take, going, you know, you're sweating bullets because you don't want to make any mistakes. You want to impress this producer, Todd Rundgren, you know.
Sure.
So we're in there sweating bullets, and he's got his feet kicked up on the console. He's leaned way back in that chair, and he's reading a book while we're playing our hearts out.
What? Well, it all worked out very well for you.
Yeah, just that easy for him.
And you also worked with Frank Zappa in 76 on Good Singing, Good Playing. How did that come about the same way, naming
a
hat?
Yes, it did, brother, that picking a name from a hat. And Zappa got picked. And then we called. We said, well, we don't even know if he would like our music. And we sent him, you know, the tracks. We sent him some tracks. And then the next move was he came to Michigan. Now, he wanted to hear us live. And he told somebody in a article, an interview that he did, that what sold him on working with Grand Funk was when he walked into the studio, and the studio was lovingly called the Swamp, because we had to dig a pond to even get the ground to do a perk test, so to put a septic in. It was kind of a wet area back there. But walking in, from the Swamp, you know, from outside, Zappa told us, we got too many songs, and we need to cut at least three or four of them, because we could only really fit 11 songs on a disc, you know, and this is back in the vinyl days. So he says, what song do you want to cut? What songs? And we go, well, we could do this, we could do that. He says, what about Don't Let Them Take Your Gun? I said, no, we ain't cutting that. I said, that's our Second Amendment song. That song has to be released. People got to be reminded of who they are and what our rights are and what our Constitution has endowed us with. And he sat and listened to me explain to him, because it does say it is absolute a well-regulated militia, and that it is necessary for the freedom of state. And the words really hit him hard. And he said, damn, man, I really didn't know about that. And he says, I've been kind of, you know, like anti-gun. I've never shot a gun. I said, do you want to shoot a gun? He says, yeah, you got guns? I said, yeah, what do you want to shoot? He says, have you got a Dirty Harry? So I go across to the farm and I grab a 44 Magnum, a Smith & Wesson Model 496. It's a stainless steel 4-inch 44 Magnum, but I put 44 special shells in it, which are a lot lighter to shoot and a lot less recoil than a 44 Magnum. And when I put them in there, I told him how to aim and everything, and I showed him on a piece of paper what that sight picture needs to look like. This is what you need to be looking at when you hold that gun up there. And I said, I could put a target up there for you. He says, no, man. He says, just put some cans out there. I want to shoot a can like they do in the movies. So I said, okay. So we put some beer cans out there. He draws down on the first can and drills it dead nuts, man. I mean, center of the can. And he freaks out that he hit it, and he comes swinging that gun around. We're all, like, ducking. You know? We're going, no, Frank, point the gun towards the ground.
That's funny.
Oh, my God. And he did become a life member of the NRA. God rest his soul.
There you go. Is there a song or an album that you're most proud of?
Yes, I'm Your Captain. That's the one that I prayed for, brother, and the Closer to Home album.
Yeah. Very nice. You are a member of the Michigan Rock and Roll Legends Hall of Fame as a solo artist in 2015. Does it matter that you guys are not in the Rock and Roll Hall of Fame?
It doesn't to me. I have a Cherokee Medal of Honor that means the world to me because they honored what I have done in the world, and my great-grandmother's full-blood Cherokee, and they honored our blood, and this was real, genuine honor society. To do the Rock Hall, it is phony, 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 and the people running it are phony, and because they don't play to the popular choice of the people, they play to their political, critical, whatever their board dreams up. And it's unfair. It's totally unfair. There's a lot of bands that don't belong in there that got in there, but it's because it's political, they were able to squeeze the right lemon and get in there. But we, you know, we're not there. And people say, why aren't you guys in the Rock and Roll Hall of Fame? And I tell them, because we don't have that brown ring around our lips.
Mark, we got about a minute left. I want to talk about your new release, From Chile with Love.
Yeah.
Brand new video. It comes out in February of 2021, right?
That's right. Yeah, it's a live recording of our show in Santiago, Chile, at Teatro Caupolicán. And it has 18 performances. There's some bonus videos comes with it, and 5 bonus songs that people have not heard before.
Whoa.
Yeah.
Looking forward to that.
The audience, man, you talk about them goosebumps. You watch this video, and we did give away a single from this video, Rock and Roll Soul, which is taken from the video, and then the live video, and then they made a video from it that's very patriotic, and we're proud to honor our veterans on Veterans Day, and on Veterans Day made that announcement that we were giving that away to honor our vets.
You need to see this video, too. It's awesome. Nice job on it, too.
Thank you, brother.
Mark Farner, thank you so much for spending time with us. We appreciate it. Continued success to you, my friend.
Phil Manicki, I appreciate it, brother. Knock them alive down there in Chi-Town.
Oh, we will do that, Mark. Mark Farner of Grand Funk Railroad, thank you so much.